Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poor Richards Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, ADST. For more, check out our website at ADST.org. ADST, American Diplomacy, warts and all. When Vesuvius erupted on August 24, 79 AD, it famously engulfed the Roman town of Pompeii and, less famously, the richer town of Herculaneum. Both places sat under 50 to 60 feet of volcanic ash until they were rediscovered in 1748. In contrast to Pompeii, the hot gas and rock flow preserved Herculaneum's organic-based objects, such as wooden roofs, beds, doors, and food. It was believed that almost all of Herculaneum's inhabitants had been able to evacuate until the 1980s, when some 300 skeletons were discovered along the seashore. This was an incredible archaeological discovery and would lead to greater insight into the lives of the Romans. However, the dig ran into serious financial difficulties. Fortunately, one American diplomat was able to get the National Geographic Society involved. Herculaneum is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Here, Walter J. Silver recalls his time in Naples as a political military officer and discusses the chance encounter that led to his involvement and the sad loss of one of the site's more unique finds. Charles Stewart Kennedy interviewed Silver beginning in January 1995.
During this time, too, I had some good friends who were in the archaeological business, the Museum of Naples, which I loved, that museum. And I get to know some of these people rather well. And I'd been to Pompeii and Herculaneum several times. It was a great place to take visitors. So one morning I get a phone call from the director of Herculaneum, Giuseppe Maggi. And he says, hey, you know, we've just dug up some skeletons on the beach. We finally dug the end of the excavation. They'd gone farther toward the ocean, and they had actually finally located the beach line, the original beach line. And there in some alcoves in this, what had been the city wall, alcoves that had been used to shelter boats, mm-hmm. fishing mm-hmm. boats, they found all these skeletons. And he said, you know, this is very interesting because it was always believed that unlike Pompeii, the people of Herculaneum managed somehow to escape in that mm-hmm. the eruption of yeah. 79 AD. And that's why we never found any skeletons. Suddenly there we are on the beach and we find all these skeletons. And I said, you know, somebody ought to be really interested in this and help pay for the continuation of this excavation, because mm-hmm. you know, we've run out of money. It's a very expensive thing. They get that ash had become practically solid
yeah,
rock.
Yeah, right? And they're right in the middle of a populated area.
Indeed. So I told him, okay, I would make some phone calls and see what I could find. So I had met one guy from the National Geographic some time before, in the company of Jim Cregan.
Oh, yes.
Remember Jim Cregan?
Jim Cregan was the political officer. He's DCM now in Rome, but he was yeah. a very astute
yeah,
political
officer.
Yeah, he's
very good. He's very good. But anyway, I'd at a party somewhere, sometime in the past, I'd met this guy from the Geographic who was, and there was Jim Cregan there. So I called Jim and asked him if he remembered this guy's name. Mm-hmm. And he did. So I called him. And I told him what had happened there, and that it would be nice if the Geographic would mm-hmm. undertake the godfather role in helping to continue this thing. And he said he would take it up with his superiors. The next thing I know, I get a phone call from, Gil Grosvenor, who was then the number one at the magazine and the organization, and the grandson of the original guy. And he said he's going to send somebody over there, take a look, see if it's worth what they wanted to do. So he sent a guy over there. And meantime, Rab had heard about this. I don't know how, but he had heard somebody that these conversations were going on. And he immediately called because he wanted to be involved if anything came of it, if anything comes of it. So I said, I'll let you know. And, of course, the magazine agreed to fund a portion of this business and also to send a paleoanthropologist to do some examinations of these skeletons and to, you know, rearticulate the skeletons to write up the condition and all that sort of thing. They sent a lady named Sarah Beisel. Sarah Beisel had been trained and under a man named Angel, who had been the number one of his kind of expertise at the Smithsonian. So she was rather good. But anyway, they agreed to send her. They gave her a grant for a year, and then they provided some funds for other things. And Rab was not very happy with all of this, because somehow he would have preferred that it happened in Rome so he could be nearby, you know. Didn't like it being so far away. And but I invited him down, and he actually came down, and he made a visit of the sites, and then he went back, and then the thing sort of went on for a couple of months, and then the Geographic was very pleased. They ran two articles on the subject of Herculaneum. They're very pleased with it. They also did a TV thing of the dig, etc. Very well done by WQED of Pittsburgh, by Joe Siemens was the guy, whose father was the Siemens of MIT.
Oh, my gosh. Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a small world that people move in. But at any rate, it was a pretty good thing. And they decided that they would come over, a group would come over, to look at the work that they'd been paying for. So they had a kind of a trustees, board of trustees, and you had the editor of the magazine. God, his name escapes me now. But anyway, the people who had done some of the writing, Gil Grosvenor, and they all came with half a dozen of their trustees to look at this thing. They all came over. And then the idea was to go to Rome and then leave. So I called up Rab and I suggested that he ought to have a reception for them and invite the important people of the government to it, because this is a major thing for Italy. You know, that National Geographic can make or break a historical site.
Sure.
So he agreed, and there was a rather nice reception to which most of the ministers came. I was really amazed. But anyway, that went on and on and on, and eventually it sort of petered out, as things tend to do in Italy. Sarah Beisel was doing a fantastic job on the bones. She discovered that, you know, women, that how many children they'd had, what they died from, the diseases they'd had. Mm-hmm. She found one of the skeletons on the beach was a Roman soldier who still had his sword with him, and there were bits and pieces of leather from his sandals. He had his tool bag on his back, something I had not realized was most Roman soldiers were also specialized craftsmen, and they carried their tools. And this guy had been some kind of a carpenter as well as a soldier and had his tools with him. And it looked as though he was trying to escape because he did have his tools with him. Mm. But then she found that the reason he was in Herculaneum was he obviously had been furloughed for a serious wound he'd received, which he had found, a broken leg with evidence of fistulas and pus and all of that sort of thing. The leg had never healed well, and he was obviously not fit for regular service, so he'd been sent down there. But anyway, that sort of thing kept coming up. Fascinating stuff. They found jewelry on a woman that obviously made her wealthy. Then they found the boat. As they're digging into beyond the beach, they found a wooden boat in a remarkable state of strange preservation. It was completely charcoal, though it had been enveloped by this hot ash, so it had completely charcoalized, and then the stuff had hardened around it. When they got rid of the hardened stuff, there you had a charcoal boat, virtually intact, with a mast, evidence of the sails, evidence of how the mast was stepped, how the lanyards were attached, everything. It was absolutely remarkable, except it was very fragile. You know, you just touch it and it fell apart. So I called the Geographic, and they were excited by it because they had also been involved in the Cyprus boat, famous thing there.
Found it underwater and
So they got a guy out of the University of Texas, I guess, which has a nautical archaeology section, which is interesting. University of Texas, of all places. And they sent this man over there from, they gave him a grant to come over and study the boat, try to do something about preserving the boat. Forget his name, he's a charming guy, absolutely charming. Had barely finished high school and had gone on to be an electrician and had been an electrician for 20 or 30 years. And he developed a hobby, a boat hobby, building first model boats and then building big boats and then got interested in boats generally and started studying them in museums and all this sort of thing. And he became, without an educational background, one of the world's great experts on ancient boats. He went to Cyprus for that boat. He went to Scandinavia for the Viking boat. You know, all this sort of thing. He's one of the great experts in the world. And he was thrilled by the boat, which he said would provide, for the first time, information on how these little sailboats were rigged in Roman times. No one knows how they rigged these sails. He was thrilled to death, and a lot of discussions and a little digging and etc. They found apparently the helmsman with an oar still in his hand underneath the boat. The boat had turned over in the waves or whatever, and he'd apparently been killed trying to escape. It was all, you know, very exciting stuff. Then the question is, how do you preserve this boat and how do you get it out of the matrix of solidified ash that was there? He came up with, you know, being the kind of person he was, with a brilliant solution. You're going to get gallons and gallons of Elmer's glue and just very carefully paint this whole charcoal boat in Elmer's glue. And you just keep applying Elmer's glue until you get a solidified boat. And then we will take it apart, bring it to shore and out into the museum and reassemble it. And by doing that, we'll also learn how it was built. Well, the Italians didn't like that idea. Or it was too simple. I mean, we had all these university professors, you know, from Rome, from Pisa, from Genoa, they came from all over to look at this boat, you know. Especially the Maritimes, you know, the guy from Venice, Genoa, Pisa, I forget where else. The old Maritime States, they have special units in their universities that deal with just that sort of thing, boats. And they thought the Elmer's glue idea was ridiculous, see. So to hell with it, we're going to do it ourselves. So while how was his name? Anyway, when our friend from the University of Texas was away, they decided to come down with a forklift. And they dug underneath the boat and put the forklift underneath where it was still solid ash and lifted it up. And, of course, it destroyed the boat. So not much is left except a few nails and a couple of bronze fittings. But that was sort of typical, you know, that things petered out. They wanted more money from the Geographic. The Geographic was not willing to give them more money. It just went on and on and on. And it just sort of dribbled away. But typically, I think. It's too bad.
That was Walter Silver recounting his time in Naples as a political military officer and his experiences with the Herculaneum Cultural Site. Thank you for listening. ADST is an independent nonprofit organization located in Arlington, Virginia. ADST's oral history collection, begun in 1986, contains over 2,500 oral histories, unveiling the horrifying, thought-provoking, and the absurd events that have helped shape foreign policy. If you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, please make a tax-deductible donation to allow ADST to continue its work at www.adst.org.